The story of change in higher education reminds me of a quote that I heard one time from the previous provost at Simmons College in Boston, where he said, yeah, the story of change in higher education is kind of like when a turtle got mugged by a bunch of snails and he said, what happened? It happened so fast.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Hi, this is Tiffany Snyder with Digital to Learn. I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
We're back this week with Chris Parrish. Welcome back, Chris.
It's good to be back. Nice to see you guys.
If you weren't able to catch part one of the podcast, you can listen in on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and our latest announcement is that we are on Pandora. So you can catch us there too. But for now, it's time for part two with Chris Parrish.
It seems like from a university perspective, you think about a liberal arts school, for example.
Yeah.
It's to their advantage to have a bank of your courses available because they're primarily going to be electives, I'm guessing, and not necessarily embedded in a program.
Yeah, no, you've got it right. We started this company with an intense focus on student outcomes and making sure that students from all backgrounds got these skills so you have a better job. What we didn't anticipate is the impact that this programming and the way that we've built things could have on the front end for universities, liberal arts universities in particular. So we had an early partner of ours said to me, you know, Chris, like you're selling me on the future of higher education is data and technical centered. And I actually believe you, but in order for me to like invest my time into something like this, like I got to understand, like, what does it do for my university on the front end, right? After all, a lot of universities have a critical eye on dollars and cents right now, which Absolutely. They should. So the analogy he gave me was, you know, there's been so many schools of nursing that have been built that I know generally it's going to cost me X dollars to build one. And if I have a school of nursing, I'll get Y more students on the front end. And then based on that sort of cost calculation, I can decide whether that project's worth it for me. There's nothing like that for what you're saying. So like, help me get there. So for a lot of our pure play liberal arts partners, what we decided to do last admission cycle was run a test where we took 50% of their admitted non-deposited students. So people sitting on the fence. And they got the standard university drip campaign, right? Marketing campaign. And then for the other 50%, they got sort of a podium tech data infused drip campaign where it said, you know, if you come to XYZ school, you'll not only be able to pursue philosophy, but you'll get this really unique opportunity to learn case studies from cool companies like Netflix and Airbnb and Spotify. We made it beautiful and glossy and really dynamic. The results were conclusive for that provost in particular. So those that got our tech-enabled messaging were 57% more likely to enroll than those that got the standard university drip campaign.
Wow.
So cool.
And it's not, I mean, it's not surprising, right? If you're a parent or even a student that is sort of shouldering the bill for these private institutions, like you've got to feel really good that if you're going to pay 3X to go there instead of the state institution, that you're going to get something really unique. And I think our partners can say that now, which is cool.
So would you say the colleges and universities are finally getting the message? I mean, change is so slow in higher education that they're finally getting the message that this is really a huge value add for their students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The story of change in higher education reminds me of a quote that I heard one time from the previous provost at Simmons College in Boston, where he said, yeah, the story of change in higher education is kind of like when a turtle got mugged by a bunch of snails and he said, what happened? It happened so fast. And it's just like,
oh, that is great. That is so true.
Yeah. You know, it's not easy. Like, you know, one of the reasons why we're the first company to sort of think that they can build coursework in a way that the university can't in some ways, right? If your faculty argue that that's our core competency, if we're sort of using an outside provider for that, what value do I bring to the table? And we clearly do not want to be a college replacement, right? Like there's boot camps out there that think you should go there instead of going to Indiana Wesleyan. We are huge believers in the four-year degree and what it can do for individuals. We just think that the components that make up that four-year degree should have some of these in-demand skills as part of them. And that's the part that like when you start to think about it from what stacks into the 120 credits, and that for most students, all we're asking is that they take a couple of the courses so that they're better prepared on the back end, it feels less like a monumental shift in higher education. Yeah. And what we're presenting is just an improvement of the current product they have.
Yeah.
So if I'm a faculty member at this institution and we decide to buy your product, what would be my role in teaching your course?
Yeah, all of our partners look a little different on that side. So for partners that have the existing capability to deliver this course, the professor of record or the adjunct is faculty at the home institution. And the way that our coursework is designed is we use a hybrid approach between asynchronous and synchronous contact. So,
yay! Mm-hmm. We love that.
You know, a year ago, pre-COVID, if I said asynchronous and synchronous, most people would look at me like, what robots are you talking about? But I love that everybody knows it now. So what we decided to do was about 2/3 of the contact time is those highly produced, right? Netflix level quality, recorded lectures. We've really developed some really cool interactive software exercises using those case studies I mentioned. So students work through that on their own throughout the course of a week. And then they come to a live lab session, right? With the adjunct, with the faculty member, and they meet face-to-face with them at least once a week. If it's running over condensed term, 7 weeks, sometimes it's twice, just to make sure that we hit the contact hour requirements. So there's always a role for faculty at the home institution in that synchronous environment. And I get a lot of times I get the question of like, oh, why don't you just go like fully asynchronous? And we would be much more efficient as a business if we didn't have the synchronous component, right? Higher education would be a lot more efficient, right, if we didn't have the synchronous component. But we definitively believe, it's clear from student feedback and outcomes related data, that those synchronous experiences are absolutely critical to student success. They're the flagship experience. And ed tech seems to go through this evolution every couple of years where there's some new hot company that is trying to sell this idea that humans can learn from robots, and it never works, right? I won't name drop any companies on here because that would be mean, but you could just Google a couple like well-funded education startups that have fizzled out in the last couple of years because they're making that pitch that faculty can be replaced by robots. And we just don't think that's the case at all. And our data bears that out. Brad, your job is safe, I promise you.
Well, maybe not. Let's not go there yet. We'll poll the people around me before we leave and see if that's really true. But it's just a nice blend, I think, of maximizing the use of technology, but also adding in that human element. That's got to be a winning combination.
Yeah. And it's not just on the faculty side, but also the support side, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what gets lost in all this is one of the benefits to us being a platform, as I mentioned before, they have this term platform business now in a lot of areas, basically means that you become more efficient or higher quality with the more partners you have. So the more partners we have, it allows us to do like really creative things. For instance, we have 24/7 academic support right now. So I would not be able to afford that if I had one or two partners. But the fact that I have 21 and 5,000 students from across the US, now I can have a PhD faculty member managing an inbox of student questions coming in overnight. And they hop on real-time Loom calls with students so they can resolve questions face-to-face with them. And that's like, as you think about the benefits of sort of sharing scale with other institutions, that's another great example. And it's also a human mediated example, which is an important component to what we do.
That's amazing.
Now, Brad and I kind of go in and out of asking futuristic questions, big picture questions, and about the details, but I'm going to ask an in the weeds question too, actually, right now. First, I'm curious. I know that employers are looking for these skills regardless of their employee's age or whether or not they went to a traditional face-to-face campus experience or online. But I am curious about your partnerships, if they're primarily with the traditional age students and campuses with face-to-face experiences, COVID aside, or the online adult experience. So that's question one from me.
90% of our enrollments are traditional students.
Okay.
We think there is numerous paths to the adult market. there's some challenges with them too. So for Indiana Wesleyan, for example, we're working with Talent Ladder, which is an extension of the university. And, you know, their focus is on upskilling. We hope to be working with the traditional campus this spring, but right now it's with the Talent Ladder. And we've been able to work with them and the state of Indiana to apply for CARES funding to back the upskilling of displaced workers across the state, which is an awesome idea, right? We did the same thing in Utah, and we'll probably be doing it in a couple other states. Makes perfect sense. In-demand skills, fully digital. They don't have to come to campus. COVID, yes, let's do it. So that makes sense to us. But the challenge with the adult completion market for us is that there's sort of two buckets of potential students in that area. Bucket one is I want to complete my degree as fast as possible, as cheap as possible, and as easy as possible. And those are three things that are really tough for us to make work, given all like the support we do and all the production quality that oftentimes we're not a great fit for that style student. But then there's this other little nugget out there of adults that are saying, you know, if I'm going to go back and complete my degree, I might as well be doing it in skills that are going to help me level up and make more money. It's harder to find that adult student, but I'm confident with the right university partners, we'll be able to figure out a strategy to hammer on that student in particular, because that's who we want to serve.
Absolutely.
Thank you for expanding on that. The second one probably is more related to online courses and adult learners, so it might not apply, but it was about course length. So different institutions have different lengths of courses, whether it's 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, a semester. And I was just wondering how your courses fit in those time constructs.
We accordion to different semester lengths. So we've done everything from 15 to 5 weeks for a course. One thing to note is, you know, we get a lot of questions about, you know, can you do your course over 2 week special winter term or anything. And
oh my,
this isn't us trying to be, you know, God's gift to the earth, but we have to say no to those opportunities because there's a real cognitive load associated with this coursework. And we're not here to just sort of sandwich in some content and like give somebody a final exam, give them a C and send them on their way. It's just not the way that we built our stuff. So anything tighter than 5 weeks, the cognitive load, especially for folks coming from non-STEM backgrounds, is real. And we're nervous to go any tighter than 5 weeks. We've had good success with 5 weeks, but it's taken a lot of effort on the support side.
So let's take a glimpse 10 years out.
Let's do it. This podcast is number one in the world.
Well, that's all right. That's true now. So, I mean, that's not a great prediction. What are some of the tech skills that you think will become more attractive to employers in the next 10 years?
I think I'm going to disrupt myself here. Here's one perspective that the world could go. When I grew up in the Poconos, my dad had a side business that he cooked pigs, did like pig pickings, right? So once again, a nice combination of my wife's Jewish family with my family, right? Perfect match.
So you didn't invite them to the pig roast, I'm guessing.
Exactly. So my dad made great pork, made a cool pig, right? 220 pounds on the grill. You guys have seen this. You're from Maryland.
Yeah.
You get it.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted to grow his business. So first thing you do when you're a small business person, I want to grow your business, you build a website. 10, 15 years ago, I don't know you remember this, but like you actually had to call like a webmaster to build the website, right? Like nobody knew how to do that on their own unless you were like a software engineer, web developer. And now, I don't know if y'all have used like Squarespace or anything, but now you can just go to Squarespace, pay 15 bucks. They have like pre-made templates. You drop in a pretty picture, update the text, and you're good to go. You don't need any technical skills for that.
Yep.
So one of the interesting evolutions to keep an eye on is this idea of no code and low code solutions for a lot of the relatively technical parts of business now. So is it possible 10 years from now that actually most of the workforce doesn't really need to know code or programming because all of these tools have been put out there where it's all low code and no code solutions? Mm-hmm. It's super possible, very possible. But I still think being familiar with sort of the back end and how all that works and some base level concepts will still put the people in a position to succeed, even if they don't know, you know, the full code or aren't a full software engineer. So those will always be in demand as things continue to grow. But I think like for the average business person, there should be tools that make your life easier over time in a lot of these different areas.
So what's the least technical thing that you teach?
What a funny question.
So it's all not like deeply technical. You know, web dev is all pretty technical. We do a web design course on that side. Intro to Applied Analytics, which is our first course in the data analytics sequence. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, the software we use in that course is Excel, right? That's what everybody uses for analytics. But the course itself is really much more about how to ask good data-driven questions, right? Business questions, how data can help you as somebody thinking through a problem and then doing really interesting things with data. But also on the flip side, like what's things to look out for, right? When we're showing these data visualizations, like we're in this election period, right? So this is an interesting one. The bias in data is always there. Mm-hmm. Understanding why a pie chart is bad, right? Like pie chart is the worst visualization you can show anybody. Our minds cannot comprehend like what each one of those slices is compared to the other ones. And oftentimes charts are poorly labeled. They're never scaled the right way. So I think that one is much more about like the human psychology behind data visualization and what sort of things to look out for when somebody's pitching you using data than anything. And I mean, that's not technical at all. And it hits us on a day-to-day basis as we read these articles that come out about all different types of things.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
This has been great, Chris. It's been so much fun to have you with us. And we're going to be following your path and the tremendous success the Podium Education is undoubtedly going to have in the coming years. Mm-hmm. So thanks for being with us on Digital to Learn.
Great to meet you all. I really appreciate being here. And we are super proud to be partnered with Indiana Wesleyan. I want to make sure to drop that in too. We're doing great things together. So appreciate both of your support and also the institutional support and everybody we've worked with so far. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.